You're not just choosing for yourself. You're choosing for everyone in the city.
So I am.
He slid some cans onto the shelf.
In the end, Megan said, they don't get to be masters of their own destinies. They get to be dominated by Steelheart or left to fend for themselves, at least until another epic comes along to dominate them again.
Then we'll kill him too,
Prof said softly.
How many can you kill? Megan said. You can't stop all of the epics, Prof. Eventually, another one will set up here. You think he'll be better than Steelheart?
Enough, Megan, Prof said. We've spoken of this already, and I made my decision.
New Kago is one of the best places in the Fractured States to live, Megan continued, ignoring Prof's comment. We should be focusing on epics who aren't good administrators, places where life is worse.
No,
Prof said, his voice sounding gruffer.
Why not?
Because that's the problem, he snapped. Everyone talks about how great New Kago is, but it's not great, Megan. It's good by comparison only. Yes, there are worse places, but so long as this hellhole is considered the ideal, we'll never get anywhere. We cannot let them convince us this is normal.
The room fell still, Megan looking taken aback by Prof's outburst. I sat down, my shoulders slumping. This wasn't anything like I'd imagined. The glorious reckoners bringing justice to the epics. I hadn't once thought of the guilt they'd bear, the arguments, the uncertainty. I could see it in them, the same fear I'd had in the power plant, the worry that we might be making things worse, that we might end up as bad as the epics. Prof stalked away, waving a hand in frustration. I heard the curtain rustle as he retreated back to his thinking room. Megan watched him go, red-faced with anger.
He's not so bad, Megan,
Abraham said quietly. He still seemed calm.
It will be all right.
How can you say that? She asked.
We don't need to defeat all of the epics, you see, Abraham said.
He was holding a chain in his dark-skinned hand, with a small pendant dangling from it.
We just need to hold out long enough.
I'm not going to listen to your foolishness, Abraham, she said. Not right now.
With that, she turned and left the storage room. She crawled into the tunnel that led down to the steel catacombs and vanished. Abraham sighed, then turned to me.
You look unwell, David.
I feel sick, I said honestly. I thought... Well, if anyone had the answers, I thought it would be the Reckoners.
You mistake us,
Abraham said, walking over to me.
You mistake Prof. Do not look to the executioner, for the reason his blade falls. And Prof is society's executioner, the warrior for mankind. Others will come to rebuild.
But doesn't it bother you? I asked.
Not unduly,
Abraham answered simply, putting his necklace back on.
But then, I have a hope the others do not.
I could now see the pendant he wore. It was small and silver with a stylized S symbol on it. I thought I recognized that symbol from somewhere. It reminded me of my father. You're one of the faithful, I guessed. I'd heard of them, though I'd never met one. The factory raised realists, not dreamers. And to be one of the faithful, you had to be a dreamer. Abraham nodded. How can you still believe that good epics will come? I asked. I mean, it's been over 10 years.
10 years is not so long, Abraham said. Not in the big picture of things. Why, humankind is not so old a species compared to the big picture. The heroes will come. Someday we will have epics that do not kill, do not hate, do not dominate. We will be protected.
Idiot, I thought. It was a gut reaction, though I immediately felt bad about it. Abraham wasn't an idiot. He was a wise man. Or it seemed so until this moment. But how could he really still think there would be good epics? It was the same reasoning that had gotten my father killed. Though at least he has something to look forward to, I thought. Would it be so bad to wish for some mythical group of heroic epics? To wait for them to come and provide salvation? Abraham squeezed my shoulder and gave me a smile, then walked away. I stood and caught sight of him, following Prof into the thinking room, something I'd never seen any of the others do. I soon heard soft conversation. I shook my head. I considered continuing with the unloading, but found I didn't have a heart for it. I glanced at the tunnel down to the catacombs. On a whim, I climbed in and went to see if I could find Megan.
24. Megan hadn't gone far. I found her at the bottom of the tunnel, sitting on a pile of old crates just outside the hideout. I walked up, hesitantly, and she shot me a suspicious glance. Her expression softened after a moment, and she turned back to studying the darkness in front of her. She had her mobile turned all the way up to give light. I climbed up on the crates beside her and sat, but didn't speak. I wanted to have the perfect thing to say, and, as usual, I couldn't figure out what that would be. Trouble was, I basically agreed with Prof, even though it made me feel guilty that I did. I didn't have the schooling to predict what would happen to New Kago if its new leader were killed. But I did know Steelheart was evil. No court would convict him, but I had a right to seek justice for the things he had done to me and mine. So I just sat there, trying to formulate something to say that wouldn't offend her, but that also wouldn't sound lame. It's harder than it seems, which is probably why I just say what comes to me most of the time. When I stop to think, I can never come up with anything.
He really is a monster, Megan eventually said. I know that he is. I hate sounding like I'm defending him. I just don't know if killing him is going to be good for the very people we're trying to protect.
I nodded. I got it. I really did. We fell silent again. As we sat, I could hear distant sounds in the corridors, distorted by the bizarre composition and acoustics of the steel catacombs. Sometimes you could hear water rushing as the city sewage pipes ran nearby. Other times I swore I could hear rats, though it baffled me what they could be living on down here. Other times the land seemed to be groaning softly.
What are they, Megan? I asked.
Have you ever wondered that?
You mean the epics? She asked. Lots of people have theories.
I know, but what do you think? She didn't reply immediately. Lots of people did have theories, and most would be happy to tell you about them. The epics were the next stage in human evolution, or they were a punishment sent by this god or that, or they were really aliens, or they were the result of a secret government project, or it was all fake. And they were using technology to pretend they had powers. Most of the theories fell apart when confronted by facts. Normal people had gained powers and become epics. They weren't aliens or anything like that. There were enough direct stories of a family member manifesting abilities. Scientists claimed to be baffled by the genetics of epics, but I didn't know much about that kind of thing. Besides, most of the scientists were either gone now or worked for one of the more powerful epics. Anyway, a lot of the rumors were silly, but that had never stopped them from spreading and probably never would.
I think they're a test of some kind, Megan said.
I frowned. You mean, like, religiously?
No, not a test of faith or anything like that, Megan said. I mean, a test of what we'll do. If we have power, enormous power, what would it do to us? How would we deal with it?
I sniffed. If the epics are an example of what we'd do with power, then it's better if we never get any. She fell silent. A few moments later, I heard another odd sound. Whistling. I turned and was surprised to see Cody walking down the corridor. He was alone and on foot, which meant he'd left the industrial scooter, which had pulled the crates of supplies, in the hangar. He had his gun over his shoulder and wore his baseball cap embroidered with the supposed coat of arms of his Scottish clan. He tipped the cap to us.
"So, we having a party?"
he asked. He checked his mobile.
"Is it time for tea?"
"Tea?" I asked. "I've never seen you drink tea."
"I usually have some fish sticks and a bag of potato chips," Cody said. "It's a British thing. Y'all are Yanks and wouldn't understand."
Something seemed off about that statement, but I didn't know enough to call him on it.
"So, why the dour expressions?"
Cody asked, hopping up beside us on the crates.
"You two look like a pair of coon hunters on a rainy day."
Wow, I thought. Why can't I come up with metaphors like that? "Prof and I got into an argument," Megan said with a sigh.
"Again? I thought you two were past that. What was it about this time?"
"Nothing I want to talk about."
"Fair enough, fair enough."
Cody got out his long hunter's knife and began trimming his fingernails.
"Knot wielder's been out in the city. People are reporting him all over, passing through walls, looking in on dens of miscreants and lesser epics. It has everyone on edge."
"That's good," I said. "It means Steelheart is taking the threat seriously."
"Maybe," Cody said. "Maybe." "He ain't said anything about the challenge we left him yet. A knight wielder is checking in on a lot of regular folks. Steelheart might suspect that someone's trying to blow smoke up his kilt."
"Maybe we should hit knight wielder," I said. "We know his weakness now."
"Might be a good idea,"
Cody said, fishing a long, slender device out of his hip pack. He tossed it to me. "What's this?"
"UV flashlight," he said. "I managed to find a place that sold them. Or, well, bulbs anyway, which I put in the flashlights and fixed us up a few. Best to be ready in case Knot Wielder surprises us."
"Do you think he'll come here?" I asked.
"He'll start in on the steel catacombs eventually," Cody said. "Maybe he started already. Having a defensible base means nothing if Knot Wielder just decides to phase through the walls and strangle us in her sleep."
Cheery thoughts. I shivered.
"At least we can fight him now,"
Cody said, fishing out another flashlight for Megan.
"But I think we're poorly prepared. We still don't know what Steelheart's weakness is. What if he does challenge Limelight?"
"Tia will find the answer," I said. "She has a lot of leads in discovering what was in that bank vault."
"And Firefight?"
Cody said.
"We haven't even started planning how to deal with him."
"Firefight, the other of Steelheart's high epic bodyguards." Megan looked at me, obviously curious as to what I'd say next. "Firefight won't be a problem," I said.
"So you said before, when you pitched this whole thing to us. But you ain't said why yet."
"I've talked it over with Tia," I said. "Firefight's not what you think he is. I was reasonably confident about that. Come on, I'll show you." Cody raised an eyebrow, but followed as I crawled back up the tunnel. Prof already knew what my notes said, though I wasn't certain he believed. I knew he was planning a meeting to talk about Firefight and Knight Wielder, but I also knew that he was waiting on Tia before moving too far ahead in the plan. If she didn't come up with the answer to how to kill Steelheart, nothing else would matter. I didn't want to think about that. Giving up now because we didn't know his weakness? It would be like finding out that you'd drawn lots for dessert at the factory and had been only one number off. Only it didn't matter because Pete already snuck in to steal the dessert, so nobody was going to get any anyway, not even Pete, because it turns out that there had never been any dessert in the first place. Well, something like that. That metaphor is a work in progress. At the top of the tunnel, I led Cody to the box where we kept my notes. I flipped through them for a few minutes, noting that Megan had followed us up. She had an unreadable expression on her face. I grabbed the folder on Firefight and brought it over to the desk, spreading out some pictures. "What do you know about Firefight?"
"Fire epic," Cody said.
Cody said, pointing at a photo.
It showed a person made of flames, the heat so intense the air around him warped. No photo could capture the details of Firefight's features, as they were composed of solid flames. In fact, each photo I pulled out showed him glowing so brightly that it distorted the picture.
He's got standard fire epic powers, Megan said. He can turn to flame. In fact, he pretty much always remains in fire form. He can fly, throw fire from his hands, and manipulate existing flames. He creates an intense heat field around him, capable of melting bullets, though they likely couldn't hurt him, even if they didn't melt. It's a basic fire epic portfolio.
Too basic, I said. Every epic has quirks. Nobody has exactly the same portfolio of powers. That was what first tipped me off. Here's the other clue. I tapped the series of photographs. Each was a shot of Firefight taken on a different day, usually with Steelheart and his retinue. Though Nightwielder often went out on missions, Firefight usually remained near Steelheart to act as first-line bodyguard. Do you see it? I asked.
See what?
Cody asked.
Here, I said, pointing to a man standing with Steelheart's guards in one of the pictures. He was slender and clean-shaven and wore a stiff suit, a pair of dark shades and a wide-brimmed hat that obscured his face. I pointed to the next photo. The same person was there, and the next photo, and the next. His face was hard to make out in the other pictures, too. None of them were focused on him specifically, and the hat and shades always masked his features.
This person is always there when Firefight appears, I said. It's suspicious. Who is it? And what is he doing there?
Megan frowned. What are you implying?
Here, I said. Take a look at these. I got out a sequence of five photos, a rapid-fire series of shots capturing a few moments. The scene was Steelheart flying through the city with a procession of his minions. He did that sometimes. Though he always looked like he was going somewhere important, I suspected these were really just his version of a parade. Nightwielder and Firefight were with him, flying about 10 feet above the ground. A cavalcade of cars drove beneath, like a military convoy. I couldn't make out any faces, though I suspected the suspicious person was among them. Five pictures, four of them showed the trio of epics flying side by side, and in one of them, right in the middle of the sequence, Firefight's shape had fuzzed and gone translucent.
Firefight can go incorporeal, like Nightwielder? Cody guessed.
No, I said. Firefight's not real.
Cody blinked.
What?
He's not real, at least not in the way we think. Firefight is an incredibly intricate and incredibly clever illusion. I suspect that the person we're seeing in those photos, the one wearing the suit and hat, is the true epic. He's an illusionist, capable of manipulating light to create images, a lot like refractionary, only on a much more powerful level. Together, the real Firefight and Steelheart concocted the idea of a fake epic much the same way we're concocting Limelight. In these photos, we're catching a moment of distraction, when the real epic wasn't concentrating on his illusion, and it wobbled and nearly vanished.
A fake epic? Megan said, dismissive. What would be the point? Steelheart wouldn't need to do that.
Steelheart has a strange psychology, I said. Trust me. I'll bet I know him better than anyone other than his closest allies. He's arrogant, like Abraham said, but he's also paranoid. Much of what he does is about holding on to power, about forcing people into line. He moves the location of his sleeping quarters. Why would he need to do that? He's immune to harm, right? He's paranoid, scared that someone will discover his weakness. He destroyed the entire bank because we might have had a hint at how he was hurt.
Lots of epics would do that, Cody noted.
That's because most epics are equally paranoid. Look, what better way to surprise would-be assassins than to make them prepare for an epic that isn't there? If they spend all their time planning how to kill Firefight, then go up against an illusionist instead, they'll be caught totally off guard.
So will we, if you're right,
Cody said.
Fighting illusionists is tough. I hate not being able to trust my eyes.
Look, an illusionist epic can't explain everything, Megan said. There are recorded events of Firefight melting bullets. Firefight made the bullets vanish when they reached the illusion, then made illusory melted bullets drop to the ground. Later, some of Steelheart's minions went and spread some actual melted bullets down as proof. I took out another pair of pictures. I've got evidence of them doing just that. I have mountains of documentation on this, Megan. You're welcome to read through it. Tia agrees with me. I picked up a few more pictures from the stack. Take this. Here, we've got photos of a time that Firefight burned down a building. I took these pictures myself. See how he's throwing fire? If you look at the scorch marks on the walls the following day in this next set, they're different from the blasts Firefight created. The real scorch marks were added by a team of workers in the night. They cleared everyone from the scene, so I couldn't get pictures of them, but the next day's evidence is clear. Megan looked deeply troubled.
What? Cody said.
It's what you said, she replied. Illusionists. They're annoying. I'm just hoping we don't have to face one.
I don't think we'll have to, I said. I've thought it through, and despite Firefight's reputation, he doesn't seem terribly dangerous. I can't squarely attribute any deaths to him, and he rarely fights. It has to be because he wants to be careful not to reveal what he really is. I've got the facts in these folders. As soon as Firefight appears, all we have to do is shoot the one creating the illusion. This man in the photos, and all of his illusions will go down. It shouldn't be too hard.
Y'all might be right about the illusions, Cody said, looking through another group of photos. But I'm not sure about this person you think is making them. If Firefight were smart, he'd create the illusion, then turn himself invisible.
It's possible he can't, I said. Not all illusionists are capable of that, even powerful ones. I hesitated. But you're right. We can't know for certain who's making the fake Firefight, but I still think Firefight won't be a problem. All we need to do is spook him, set up a trap that will expose his illusion as fake. When he's threatened with being revealed, I'll bet he bolts. From what I've been able to determine about him, he seems like something of a coward. Cody nodded thoughtfully. Megan shook her head. I think you're taking this too lightly. She sounded angry. If Steelheart really has been fooling everyone all this time, then it's likely that Firefight is even more dangerous than we thought. Something about this bothers me. I don't think we're prepared for it. You're looking for a reason to call off this mission anyway, I said, annoyed at her. I never said that. You didn't need to. I was interrupted by motion at the tunnel into the hideout, and I turned in time to see Tia climbing through, wearing old jeans and her Reckoner jacket. Her knees were dusty. She stood up, smiling.
We found it.
My heart leaped in my chest and sent what felt like electricity jolting through my body. Steelheart's weakness? You found out what it is?
No,
she said, her eyes seeming to glow with excitement. But this should lead to the answer. I found it.
What, Tia? Cody asked.
The bank vault.
25.
I first started considering this possibility when you told your story, David,
Tia explained. The entire team of Reckoners was following her down a tunnel in the steel catacombs.
And the more I investigated the bank, the more curious I became. There are oddities.
Oddities? I asked. The group moved in a tense huddle, Cody taking point, Abraham watching our tail. He had replaced his very nice machine gun with a similar one, only without quite as many bells and whistles. I felt pretty comfortable with him at our back. These narrow confines would make a heavy machine gun especially deadly to anyone trying to approach us. The walls would work like bumpers on the sides of a bowling lane, and Abraham wouldn't have any trouble at all getting strikes.
The diggers,
Prof said. He was at my side.
They weren't allowed to excavate the area beneath where the bank had stood.
Yes, Tia said, speaking eagerly. It was very irregular. Steelheart barely gave them any direction. The chaos of these lower catacombs proves that. Their madness made them hard to control. But one order he was firm on, the area beneath the bank was to be left alone. I wouldn't have thought twice about that if it hadn't been for what you described. That Steelheart had most of the main room of the bank turned to steel by the time Fault Line came that afternoon. Her powers had two parts. It...
Yes, I said, too excited not to interrupt.
Fault Line, the woman Steelheart had brought to bury the bank after I'd escaped. I know power duality. Melding two second-tier abilities creates a first-tier one.
Tia smiled.
You've been reading my classification system notes.
I figure we might as well use the same terminology, I shrugged. I have no trouble switching over.
Megan glanced at me, the hint of a smile on the corners of her lips.
What?
I asked.
Nerd.
I am not.
Stay focused, son,
Prof said, shooting a hard look at Megan, whose eyes shone with amusement.
I happen to have a fondness for nerds.
I never said that I didn't, Megan replied lightly. I'm just interested whenever someone pretends to be something they're not.
Whatever, I thought. Fault Line was a tier one epic, by Tia's classification, without an immortality benefit. That made her powerful but fragile. She should have realized that when she'd tried to seize New Kago a few years back. She'd never had a chance. Anyway, she was an epic who had several smaller powers that worked together to create what seemed to be a single more impressive power. In her case, she could move Earth, but only if it wasn't too rigid. However, she also had the ability to turn ordinary stone and earth into a kind of sandy dust. What had looked like her creating an earthquake had actually been her softening the ground, then pulling back the earth. There were true earthquake-creating epics, but they were, ironically, less powerful, or at least less useful. The stronger ones could destroy a city with their powers, but couldn't bury a single building or group of people at will. Plate tectonics just worked on too massive a scale to allow for precision.
Don't you see? Tia asked. Steelheart turned the bank's main room, walls, much of the ceiling, floor, to steel. Then Fault Line softened the ground beneath it and let it sink. I began thinking there might be a chance that... that it would still be there, I said softly.
We turned a corner in the catacombs, and then Tia stepped forward, moving some pieces of junk to reveal a tunnel. I had enough practice by now to tell it was probably tensor-made. The tensors, unless controlled precisely, always created circular tunnels, while the diggers had created square or rectangular corridors. This tunnel burrowed through the steel at a slight decline. Cody walked up, shining his light in.
Well, I guess now we know what you and Abraham have been working on for the last few weeks, Tia.
We had to try several different avenues of approach, Tia explained. I wasn't certain how deep the bank room ended up sinking, or even if it retained structural integrity.
But it did?
I asked, suddenly feeling a strange numbness.
It did, Tia said. It's amazing. Come see.
She led the way down the tunnel, which was tall enough to walk through, though Abraham would have to stoop. I hesitated. The others waited for me to follow, so I forced myself forward, joining Tia. The rest of them came along behind, our mobiles providing the only light. No, wait. There was light up ahead. I could barely make it out, around the shadows of Tia's slender figure. We eventually reached the end of the tunnel, and I stepped into a memory. Tia had set up a few lights in corners and on tables, but they did little more than give a ghostly cast to the large, dark chamber. The room had settled at an angle, with the floor sloping downward. The skewed perspective only enhanced the surreal sensation of this place. I froze in the mouth of the tunnel. The room was as I remembered it, shockingly well-preserved. Towering pillars, now made of steel, and scattered desks, counters, rubble. I could still make out the tile mosaic on the floor, though only its shape. Instead of marble and stone, it was now all a uniform shade of silver broken by ridges and bumps. There was almost no dust,
though some motes dodged lazily in the air, creating little halos around the white lanterns Tia had set up. Realizing that I was still standing in the mouth of the tunnel, I stepped down into the room. Oh, sparks, I thought, my chest constricting. I found my hands gripping my rifle, though I knew I was in no danger. The memories were coming back in a flood.
In retrospect, Tia was explaining.
I listened with only half an ear.
I shouldn't have been surprised to find it so well preserved. Faultline's powers created a kind of cushion of earth as the room sank, and Steelheart turned almost all of that earth to metal. The other rooms in the building were destroyed in his assault on the bank, and they broke off as the structure sank. But this one, and the attached vault, were ironically preserved by Steelheart's own powers.
By coincidence, we'd entered through the front of the bank. There had been wide, beautiful glass doors here. Those had been destroyed in the gunfire and energy blasts. Steel rubble and some steel bones from Death Point's victims littered the ground to both sides. As I stepped forward, I followed the path Steelheart had taken into the building. Those are the counters, I thought, looking directly ahead. The ones where the tellers worked. One section had been destroyed. As a child, I'd crawled through that gap before making my way to the vault. The ceiling nearby was broken and misshapen, but the vault itself had been steel before Steelheart's intervention. Now that I thought about it, that might have helped preserve its contents because of how his transversion abilities worked.
Most of the rubble is from where the ceiling fell in,
Tia said from behind, her voice echoing in the vast chamber.
Abraham and I cleaned as much out as we could. A large amount of dirt had tumbled through the broken wall and ceiling, filling one part of the chamber over by the vault. We used the tensors on that pile, then made a hole in the corner of the floor. It opens into a pocket of space underneath the building. He shoved the dust in there.
I moved down three steps to the lower section of the floor. Here, at the center of the room, was where Steelheart had faced Death Point. These people are mine. By instinct, I turned to the left. Huddling beside the pillar, I found the body of the woman whose child had been killed in her arms. I shivered. She was now a statue made of steel. When had she died? How? I didn't remember. A stray bullet, maybe? She wouldn't have been turned to steel unless she'd already been dead.
What really saved this place, Tia continued, was the great transversion, when Steelheart turned everything in the city to steel. If he hadn't done that, dirt would have filled this room completely. Beyond that, the settling of the ground probably would have caved in the ceiling. However, the transversion turned the remaining things in the room to steel, as well as the earth around it. In effect, he locked the room into place, preserving it like a bubble in the middle of a frozen pond.
I continued forward until I could see the sterile little mortgage cubicle I'd hidden in. Its windows were now opaque, but I could see in through the open front. I walked in and ran my fingers along the desk. The cubicle felt smaller than I remembered.
The insurance records were inconclusive, Tia continued. But there was a claim submitted on the building itself, an earthquake claim. I wonder if the bank owners really thought the insurance company would pay out on that. Seems ridiculous, but of course there was still a lot of uncertainty surrounding epics in those days. Anyway, that made me investigate records surrounding the bank's destruction.
And that led you here?
Cody asked, his voice coming from the darkness as he poked around the perimeter of the room.
No, actually. It led me to find something curious, a cover-up. The reason I couldn't find anything in the insurance reports, and why I couldn't find any lists of what was in the vault, was because some of Steelheart's people had already gathered and hidden the information. I realized that since he had made a dedicated attempt to cover this up, I would never discover anything of use in the records. Our only chance would be to come to the bank, which Steelheart had assumed was buried beyond reach.
It's a good assumption,
Cody said, sounding thoughtful.
Without the tensors or some kind of epic power like the diggers had, getting here would have been near impossible. Burrowing through 50 feet of solid steel?
The diggers had started out as normal humans and had been granted their strange powers by an epic known as Dig Zone, who was a gifter like Conflux. It hadn't gone well for them. Not all epic powers were meant to be used by mortal hands, it appeared. I was still standing in the cubicle. The mortgage man's bones were there, scattered on the floor around the desk, peeking out from some rubble. All of it was metal now. I didn't want to look, but I had to. I had to. I turned around. For a moment, I couldn't tell the past from the present. My father stood there, determined, gun raised to defend a monster. Explosions, shouts, dust, screams, fire. Fear. I blinked, trembling, hand to the cold steel of the cubicle wall. The room smelled of dust and age, but I thought I could smell blood. I thought I could smell terror. I stepped out of the cubicle and walked to where Steelheart had stood, holding a simple pistol, arm extended toward my father. Bang. One shot. I could remember hearing it, though I didn't know if my mind had constructed that. I'd been deafened by the explosions by then. I knelt beside the pillar. A mound of silvery rubble covered everything in front of me. But I had my tensor. The others continued talking, but I stopped paying attention, and their words became nothing more than a low hum in the background. I put on my tensor, then reached forward and, very carefully, began vaporizing bits of rubble. It didn't take long. The bulk of it was made of one large piece of ceiling panel. I destroyed it, then froze. There he was. My father lay slumped against the pillar, head to the side. The bullet wound was frozen in the steel folds of his shirt. His eyes were still open. He looked like a statue, cast with incredible detail. Even the pores of the skin were clear. I stared, unable to move, unable to even lower my arm. After 10 years, the familiar face was almost crushing to me. I didn't have any pictures of him or my mother. I hadn't dared go home after surviving, though Steelheart couldn't have known who I was. I'd been paranoid and traumatized. Seeing his face brought that all back to me. He looked so normal. Normal in a way that hadn't existed for years. Normal in a way that the world didn't deserve any longer. I wrapped my arms around myself, but I kept looking at my father's face. I couldn't turn away.
David.
Prof's voice. He knelt down beside me. My father, I whispered. He died fighting back, but he also died protecting Steelheart. And now here I am, trying to kill the thing he rescued. It's funny, eh? Prof didn't respond. In a way, I said, this is all his fault. Death Point was going to kill Steelheart from behind.
It wouldn't have worked, Prof said. Death Point didn't know how powerful Steelheart was. Nobody knew back then.
I guess that's true, but my father was a fool. He couldn't believe that Steelheart was evil.
Your father believed the best about people,
Prof said.
You could call that foolish, but I'd never call it a fault. He was a hero, son. He stood up to and killed Death Point, an epic who had been slaughtering wantonly. If, in doing so, he let Steelheart live, well, Steelheart hadn't done terrible things at that point. Your father couldn't know the future. You can't be so frightened of what might happen that you are unwilling to act.
I stared into my father's dead eyes, and I found myself nodding.
That's the answer, I whispered. It's the answer to what you and Megan were arguing about.
It isn't her answer,
Prof said.
But it's mine, and maybe yours, too.
He gave my shoulder a squeeze, then went to join the rest of the Reckoners, who were standing near the vault. I'd never expected to see my father's face again. I'd left that day feeling like a coward, seeing him mouth the plea for me to run and escape. I'd lived 10 years with the single dominating emotion, the need for vengeance, the need to prove I was not a coward. Now here he was, looking into those steel eyes. I knew my father wouldn't care about vengeance. But he'd kill Steelheart all the same if he had the chance to stop the murders. Because sometimes you need to help the heroes along. I stood up. Somehow I knew, in that moment, that the bank vault and its contents were a false lead. That hadn't been the source of Steelheart's weakness. It had been my father, or something about him. I left the corpse for the moment, joining the others.
Very careful as we open the vault boxes, Tia was saying. We don't want to destroy what might be inside.
I don't think it will work, I said, drawing all of their eyes. I don't think the vault contents are to blame.
You said Steelheart looked at the vault after the rocket blew it open, Tia said. And his agents worked very hard to obtain and hide any lists of what was in here.
I don't think he knew how he got hurt, I said. A lot of epics don't know their weaknesses at first. He quietly had his people gather those records and analyze them so he could try to figure it out.
So maybe he found the answer there,
Cody said with a shrug. I raised an eyebrow. If he'd found out this vault contained something that made him vulnerable, do you think this place would still be here? The others grew silent. No, it wouldn't still be there. If that had been the case, Steelheart would have burrowed down and destroyed the place, no matter the difficulty in doing so. I was increasingly certain that it wasn't an object that had made him weak. It was something about the situation. Tia's face looked dark. She probably wished I'd mentioned this before she spent days excavating. I couldn't help it, though, since nobody had told me what she was doing.
Well, Prof said, we're going to search this vault. David's theory has merit, but so does the theory that something in here weakened him.
Will we be able to find anything? Cody asked. Everything's been turned to steel. I don't know that I'll be able to recognize much if it's all fused together.
Some things might have survived in their original form, Megan said. In fact, it's likely that they did. Steelheart's transversion powers are insulated by metal.
They're what? Cody asked.
Insulated by metal, I repeated. He exerts a kind of ripple of transversion that travels through and changes nonmetal substances, like sound travels through air or waves move through a pool of water. If the wave hits metal, particularly iron or steel, it stops. He can affect other kinds of metal, but the wave moves more slowly. Steel stops it entirely.
So these safe deposit boxes, Cody said, stepping into the vault.
Might have insulated their contents, Megan finished, following him in. Some of it will have been transformed. The wave that created the transversion was enormously powerful. I think we might find something, though, particularly since the vault itself was metal and would work as a primary insulator.
She glanced over her shoulder and caught me looking at her.
What?
She demanded.
Nerd, I said.
Uncharacteristically, she blushed furiously.
I pay attention to Steelheart. I wanted to be familiar with his powers since we were coming into the city.
I didn't say it was a bad thing, I said lightly, stepping into the vault and raising my tensor. I just pointed it out. Never has getting glared at felt so good. Prof chuckled.
All right, he said. Cody,
Abraham, David, vaporize the fronts of the safe deposit boxes, but don't destroy the contents. Tia, Megan, and I will start pulling them out and going through them for anything that looks interesting. Let's get to work. This is going to take a while.
26.
Well,
Cody said, looking over the heap of gemstones and jewelry,
if this achieved nothing else, it at least made me rich. That's a failure I can live with.
Tia snorted, picking through the jewelry. We four, including Prof, sat around a large desk in one of the cubicles. Megan and Abraham were on guard duty, watching the tunnel into the bank chamber. There was a hallowed feeling to the room, like I somehow had to show respect, and I think the others must have sensed it too. They spoke in low, muted voices, all except Cody. He tried to lean back on his chair as he held up a large ruby, but, of course, the steel chair legs were fused to the steel floor.
That once might have made you rich, Cody, Tia said, but you'd have some trouble selling it now.
That was true. Jewelry was practically worthless these days. There were a couple epics who could create gemstones.
Maybe, Cody said, but gold remains a standard.
He scratched his head.
Not sure why, though. You can't eat it, which is all most people are interested in.
It's familiar, Prof said. It doesn't rust, it's easy to shape, and it's hard to fake. There aren't any epics who can make it, yet. People need to have a way to trade, particularly across kingdom or city boundaries.
He fingered a gold chain.
Cody's actually right.
I am?
Cody looked surprised. Prof nodded.
Whether or not we take on Steelheart, the gold we've recovered here can fund the Reckoners for a few years on its own.
Tia set her notebook on the desk, tapping it absently with her pen. On the other mortgage cubicle desks, we'd arranged what we'd found in the vault. About 3/4 of the box's contents had been recoverable.
Mostly we have a lot of wills, Tia said, opening a can of cola. Stock certificates, passports, copies of driver's licenses.
We could fill a whole city with fake people if we wanted, Cody said. Imagine the fun.
The second largest grouping, Tia continued, is the aforementioned pile of jewelry, both valuable and worthless. If something in there affected Steelheart, then by pure volume, this is the most likely group.
But it's not, I said. Prof sighed.
David, I know what you—
What I mean, I interrupted, is that jewelry doesn't make sense. Steelheart didn't attack other banks, and he hasn't done anything, either directly or indirectly, to forbid people from wearing jewelry in his presence. Jewelry is common enough among epics that he'd have to take measures.
I agree, Tia said, though only in part. It's possible we've missed something. Steelheart has proven subtle in the past. Perhaps he has a secret embargo on a certain type of gemstone. I'll look into it, but I think David's right. If something did affect Steelheart, then it's likely one of the oddities.
How many of those are there?
Prof asked.
Over 300, Tia said with a grimace. Mostly mementos or keepsakes of no intrinsic value. Anything among them could be our culprit, theoretically. But then there's a chance it was something one of the people in the room was carrying on them. Or it could be, as David seems to think, something about the situation.
It's very rare for an epic's weakness to be influenced just by proximity to something mundane, I said, shrugging. Unless an object in the vault emitted a kind of radiation, or a light, or a sound, something that actually reached Steelheart. The chances are slim it was the culprit.
Look through the items anyway, Tia, Prof said. Maybe we can find a correlation to something Steelheart has done in the city. What about the darkness?
Cody asked.
Nightwielder's darkness?
Sure, Cody said. I've always thought it was strange that he kept it so dark here.
That's probably because of Nightwielder himself, I said. He doesn't want sunlight shining on him and making him corporeal. I wouldn't be surprised if that was part of the deal between them, one of the reasons Nightwielder serves beneath Steelheart. Steelheart's government provides infrastructure, food, electricity, crime prevention, to compensate for it always being dark.
I suppose that makes sense, Cody said. Nightwielder needs darkness, but can't have it unless he's got a good city to work from. Kind of like a Piper needs a good city to support him, so he can stand on the cliff tops and play.
A Piper? I asked.
Oh, please, don't get him started,
Tia said, raising a hand to her head.
Bagpiper,
Cody said. I looked at him blankly.
You've never heard of bagpipes?
Cody asked, sounding aghast.
They're as Scottish as kilts and red armpit hair.
Yuck, I said.
That's it, Cody said. Steelheart has to fall so we can get back to educating children properly. This is an offense against the dignity of my motherland. Great,
Prof said.
I'm glad we now have proper motivation.
He tapped the desk idly.
You're worried,
Tia said. She seemed to be able to read Prof pretty well.
We're getting closer and closer to a confrontation. If we continue on this course, we'll draw Steelheart out, but we'll be unable to fight him.
The people at the desk grew still. I looked up, gazing at the high ceiling. The sterile white lights around the room provided insufficient glow to reach the room's farthest corners. It was cold in this room and quiet. When's the last moment we could pull out?
Well,
Prof said,
we could draw him to a confrontation with Limelight, then not show. That might be kind of fun on its own merits, Cody noted. I doubt Steelheart gets stood up very often. He'd react poorly to the embarrassment,
Prof said.
Right now, the Reckoners are a thorn, an annoyance. We've only done 3 hits in his city and have never killed anyone vital to his organization. If we run, what we've been doing will get out. Abraham and I set in place evidence that will prove we're behind this. That is the only way to make sure our victory, if we obtain one, isn't attributed to an epic instead of ordinary men. So, if we run,
Cody said,
Steelheart will know that Limelight was a fake and that the Reckoners were working on a way to assassinate him, Tia said.
Well,
Cody said,
most epics already want to kill the lot of us, so maybe nothing will change.
This will be worse, I said, still looking up at the ceiling. He killed the rescue workers, Cody. He's paranoid. He'll hunt us actively if he finds out what we've been up to. The thought that we tried to get to him, that we were researching his weakness, he won't take that sitting down. The shadows flickered, and I looked down to see Abraham walking up to our cubicle.
Prof, you asked me to warn you when we reached the hour.
Prof checked his mobile, then nodded.
We should be getting back to the hideout. Everyone grab a sack and fill it with the things we found. We'll sort through them further in a more controlled environment.
We got up from our seats. Cody, patting the head of the dead and steel-frozen bank patron who slumped beside the wall of this particular cubicle. As they left, Abraham set something down on the desk.
For you.
It was a handgun. I'm no good with... I trailed off. It looked familiar. The gun. The one my father picked up.
I found it in the rubble beside your father,
Abraham said.
The transversion turned the grip and frame to metal, but most of the parts were already good steel. I removed the magazine and cleared the chamber, and the slide and trigger still function as expected. I wouldn't completely trust it until I give it a thorough once over, back at base. But there's a good chance it will fire reliably.
I picked up the gun. This was the weapon that had killed my father. Holding it felt wrong. But it was also, so far as I knew, the only weapon ever to have wounded Steelheart.
We can't know if it was something about the gun that allowed Steelheart to be hurt,
Abraham said.
I felt it would be worth digging out. I'll take it apart and clean it for you. Check over the cartridges. they should still be good, though I might need to change the powder if the casings didn't insulate against the transversion. If it all checks out, you can carry it. If the opportunity presents itself, you can try shooting him with it.
I nodded in thanks, then ran to get a sack and haul out my part of what we'd found.
"Piping is the most sublime sound y'all have ever heard,"
Cody explained, gesturing wildly as we walked down the corridor toward the hideout.
"A sonorous mix of power, frailty, and wonder."
"It sounds like dying cats being stuffed into a blender,"
Tia said to me. Cody looked wistful.
"Aye, and a beauteous melody that is, lass."
"So wait," I said, holding up a finger. "These bagpipes, to make them you, what was it you said? Y'all need to kill yourself a wee dragon, which are totally real and not at all mythological. They live in the Scottish Highlands to this day."
"Aye," Cody said. "It's important y'all pick a wee one. The big ones are too dangerous, you see, and their bladders don't make good pipes. But you have to kill it yourself, you see. A piper needs to have slain his own dragon. It's part of the code."
"After that," I said, "you need to cut out the bladder and attach, what was it?"
"Carved unicorn horns to make the pipes,"
Cody said.
"I mean, you could use something less rare like ivory, but if you're going to be a purist, it has to be unicorn horns."
"Delightful," Tia said.
"A grand word to choose," Cody said. "It, of course, is originally a Scottish term, Del coming from Dalriada, the ancient and great Scottish kingdom of myth. Why, I think one of the great piping songs is from that era.
Abraser eda choice eda dunedin."
"Abha what?" I asked.
"Abraser eda choice ena dunedin,"
Cody said.
"It is a sweetly poetic name that doesn't really translate to English."
"It means the devil went down to Edinburgh in Scottish Gaelic," Tia said, leaning in toward me but speaking loudly enough that Cody could hear. Cody, for once, missed a step.
"You speak Scottish Gaelic, lass?"
"No," Tia said, "but I looked that up last time you told this story."
You did, eh?"
"Yes, though your translation is questionable."
"Well now, I always did say you were a smart one, lass." "Yes, indeed."
He coughed into his hand.
"Ah, look, we're at the base. I'll continue the story later."
The others had arrived at the hideout just ahead, and Cody scurried up to meet them, then followed Megan up the tunnel. Tia shook her head, then walked with me to the tunnel. I went last, making sure the cords and cables that hid the entrance were in place. I turned on the hidden motion sensors that would alert us if someone came in, then crawled up myself.
"Just don't know, Prof,"
Abraham was saying in his soft voice.
"I just don't know."
The two of them had spent the trip back walking ahead, speaking softly. I'd tried to edge up to hear them, but Tia had pointedly placed a hand on my shoulder and drawn me back.
"So?"
Megan asked, crossing her arms as we all gathered around the main table.
"What's going on?"
"Abraham doesn't like the way the rumors are going,"
Prof said.
"The general public does not seem to accept our tale of limelight,"
Abraham said.
"They are scared, and our hit on the power station has had an effect. There are rolling blackouts all over the city. However, I see no proof that Steelheart believes. Enforcement is sweeping the understreets. Nightwielder is scouring the city. Everything I hear from informants is that Steelheart is searching for a group of rebels, not a rival epic."
"So we hit back with a fury,"
Cody said, crossing his arms and leaning back against the wall beside the tunnel.
"Kill a few more epics."
"No," I said, remembering my conversation with Prof. "We need to be more focused. We can't just take out random epics. We have to think like someone trying to capture the city." Prof nodded.
"Each and every hit we make without having limelight appear in the open will make Steelheart more suspicious."
"We're giving up?" Megan said.
a hint of eagerness in her voice, though she obviously tried to cover it.
Not by a mile,
Prof